You're listening to Cooper Talk.
Welcome to Cooper Talk. I'm your host, Steve Cooper. And remember, I'm only as hip as my guests. And I got to tell you, people, this is a special episode. This is my 1,000th episode of Cooper Talk. And I'm very excited. I came to my friend Joe Gangemi's studio down here in Mount Laurel, New Jersey. You can check him out if you have a podcast. If you want to start a podcast, check him out at Sweet Recording, SUITE recording.com, or email him at hello@sweetrecording.com. And for my 1,000th episode, I have a very special guest. He is co-founder of Motley Crue, and he has a great new album out. It's called The Other Side of Mars. And if you go to his website, mick-mars.com, you can buy an autographed CD or album from him. And my guest is Mick Mars. How you doing, Mick?
Good. How are you doing?
I'm doing good.
Congratulations on your 1,000th show.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad you're here to share it with me. And I want to talk about the album because I really enjoy it. And now, how long have you been brewing the solo album? You talked about a solo album in the past, but what made you do it now?
Really, it was because when I retired from touring, of course, I started like really, you know, it goes back further, but I'll just take it from here. Okay. A few years ago, I mean, I've been thinking forever and ever about it, but it really started taking shape a few years ago. I had it done probably 2 years ago, and so it's like, you know, a few things in a way, but finally got it out. And you know, it took a little time, but I got it done.
Now, how did you go about it? First of all, did you first start writing? I know you wrote some songs with Paul. Did you start writing it first? Did you get your band together first? Did you get your producer first? I want to know the whole process because it's a great album and the music's great, but how did you get it started?
Well, I had a lot of ideas of a lot of ideas for songs. And so I called up because I needed help because I was doing all the recording and all the engineering and all the everything by myself. So I called up Michael Wagoner, who did the very first Crue album and did a few things with me before Motley. And so I called him up and I go, hey, you know, anybody that would, you know, help me engineer my record? And he goes, yeah, me. So he came over and we did a few things. I said, you know what? I think I need a co-writer. Do you know anybody? And he goes, yeah. And he brought over Paul and he sat and listened to stuff and he goes, oh yeah, yeah, yeah. And he was digging it. So he got on board with me and we started like putting together a lot of stuff. And I go, okay, now what we're needing is singers, you know? So again, Paul introduced me to Jacob and of course to Brian Gamboa and, you know, and of course, Ray Luzier was on drums, but that was another Michael Wagoner thing. He goes, hey, what about Ray Luzier? And I go, okay, I'll take him right away. So I didn't think that he would go for it, you know, because our, you know, Korn and stuff is like so different, you know. I mean, from I don't know what he was thinking, if it was going to be like, you know, those you know, old style 80s stuff or, you know. So I was like a little concerned, but he came over and he heard him. He's going like, yeah, he dug it and he did a great job. And so that was my team.
Now, how would you classify the music of this album? Because it's got a lot of different places. You know, you have some violas, you have a instrumental song. But if someone said, hey, Mick, tell me what The Other Side of Mars, what kind of music is it? What would you say?
I say for the songs that I put on there are pretty diverse. And I wanted them to be diverse to take... you know, like a mini journey through what's thoughts are in my mind, you know, different places or different themes or different areas of music, anything from like the ballad with just a piano, and to like something, thick, like Loyal to the Lion and Undone and Killing Breed. It's pretty diverse, and that's really, what was going on with me at that time.
Now,
My time. Go ahead.
how do you find the lyrics? Like, do you what comes first for you, the music or the lyrics, or does it work hand in hand?
What happens for me first is when I'm writing a song, is like I get like a theme of what the song is about. Paul writes lyrics. So I tell Paul, like, I need this, like this, or this, or this. And he goes, like, okay. And he writes it down, and it's like perfect. That's what I'm thinking. I'm like say Loyal to the Lie. It's like I wanted about cults, about, how people can fall for that so easily, and why do they give away all of their stuff to all of this, to all, you know what I mean? And it's like, and they end up with nothing, or die, but I mean, it sounds kind of morbid, but it's like something that I wanted to say. And so Loyal to the Lie, and it's like he came up with the right stuff.
Now, because you come from a background of albums, and I always talk to people, when you're a certain age, I just turned 60. So I love albums. I look, when I was a kid, I'd ride my bike and I get the album and I look at the album and you want every track in sync, and it's a great thing. For you, when it came to putting the songs in order, was that you doing it? Was that your producer? Was that the band? Like, was that Paul and these guys saying, we got to do this? Or how did you find the order? Because there are a lot of different sounds on this album, but they mesh, and that's good, because you hear something, you're like, oh yeah, and then you go, oh, okay, and then you, oh yeah, and it's got one of those things. How did you figure that out? Was that a long process for you?
Not really. I just, I thought, like, when the album starts, of course, you need like something to grab attention. So Loyal to the Lie was something that would grab you right away. But I figured that it needed like another heavy thing, but a little off kilter, I guess, with Broken on the Inside. And it has like some weird solos in it and stuff like that. And then to take it to more of a middle, kind of like, don't know how to even explain this song. It's just like it's more mellow. And then another, after Alone, that the third song, the fourth one on that one, Killing Breed, was to bring them to bring the attention back on heavier type of music, but a different type of heavier music, which is a direction I'm really, really liking a lot. The same with Undone,
Why
and so
are you like, so real quick, why are you liking that direction?
because I feel it more. I feel it. Do musicians ever mature? Probably not. But it's like to take myself to the next level, I guess, instead of like putting out the same type of songs I did, with big hooks and melodies as are, so I want to go a different direction, mostly for that, to change myself, to reinvent myself, to reinvent, and how I think, how everything, so that's what I was doing.
So you're growing, and that's good. Now the last song is LA Noir. That's an instrumental. And that's, instrumentals are great. And it's something you don't hear enough of them. But what made you decide to say, I'm gonna close the album off, just an instrumental, and I'm gonna be playing guitar, and I'm gonna say, this is Mick Mars' album.
That song came about as I only had nine songs. I mean, I had a lot more than that, but I didn't care much for the others. They didn't feel quite done. And I had L.A. Noire, the lick, for a lot of years, right? And so I just said, okay, I'm just going to take this and make it an instrumental, because I guess the reason for I wanted to put that on there also is, those 1940s, 1930s and 40s B movies, the sleuth kind of things, walking down the, all this, I don't know, just something to do, and I don't know, extend off into another place, but I really like that kind of music, and that feel, the 6/8 kind of a feel, or 6/4 kind of feel, from those old movies.
Now you also made some videos. Now I got to ask you, because these videos you're the star of. Now back in the day, Motley Crue videos and all 80s videos were over the top. I mean, the budgets were huge, and imagine it was glitz when it came to making these videos. Because once you walking through the woods, I mean, it's just Mick, and then there's you playing the guitar, and you're the star. How important that was to you? Were you did was it easy for you to shoot those videos? You being the main focus?
I it is the other side of Mars, isn't it? But I don't really have a band. It's like I have a lot of, some of my, well, they're now friends, but this was like, I mean, my album, and it was really, without sounding like I'm conceited, butt or anything, but yeah, I mean, it was like, I guess, I don't know. I didn't feel weird, but I felt like, different, because I was doing everything myself, But I think that's about it,
Now, when did you start playing guitar? I read something that said when you were three, you saw a country performer and you knew that's what you want to do. Is that a true story?
That's true, absolutely true. I may have been four. It was, I know that it was before I went to kindergarten, and I saw this guy at a 4-H fair in Indiana, where they have like the cows and the pigs, and I grew the biggest pumpkin kind of, and I saw him there, Skeeter Bond, and this orange outfit with this white hat, but these sparkly things all over the place. When you're a kid, you don't know what it is, but it, I just went like, wow, and that's what I wanted to do.
So how did you go about it? When did you first pick up the guitar? Did you tell your parents? Because when I was, when we're little, we say we want to do things. I wanted to be a sportscaster. And then I wanted, of course, I wanted to be an athlete, but I sucked at sports. And I wanted to be a musician, but I took guitar lab in high school and I sucked. So I said, all right. So I ended up going into the world of comedy and I toured for a few years, about 10 years. But for you, when did you know I mean, when did you pick up the guitar for the first time?
Well, it's kind of a weird story. It takes a excuse me. It'll take a minute to explain
That's
it.
fine. I want to hear it.
Christmas time, right? My father would always buy those big long socks. I don't know if you remember those, but they always had a guitar in them with rubber bands. Well, I took those for as far back as I can remember them. And I finally got like almost a real guitar when I was about maybe 6, maybe 7, maybe. But it was a mouse guitar, one of those wind up ones. But I just started learning how to play like on a single string, on melodies, off the hits of the times back then in the 50s, And it went up until I was 12 when I forgot, when I got my very first guitar, a real one, an acoustic one, and took one or two lessons from my neighbor, mostly to learn how to tune my guitar. But, you know, and then went from there. Just started learning how to play stuff.
Now, you've influenced a lot of guitars, you know. I mean, I know a lot of people don't like to hear that. They're, you know, like you said, you're a legendary guitarist. You've influenced people. When you were young and starting, who did you look up to? Did someone change your life? Did you hear Hendrix, or did you hear someone, or who did you look up to? Who was your, like, this is my idol, this is what I want to do?
Started out with actually Michael Bloomfield. And you know who he is, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. And when I heard that, because I wanted to learn how to play solos and learn how to play, you know, things. And all that was on the radio really was, like, you know, those little pop songs and stuff. And when I discovered Michael Bloomfield of Paul Butterfield Blues Band, I was like flipped out, you know, and started like going more and more and more and more in that direction. And then out jumps Alvin Lee. And I'm going like, oh, you know, and, you know, goofing around with that stuff. Out comes Jimi Hendrix, totally different than everything that I was learning. And I was going, wow, listen to that. So, you know, and, you know, it took me, you know, a little more direction, but it was still bluesy, you know. But he had like this way of doing it, you know. So, and then, God, then after that was just like all out like craziness, you know. Jeff Beck and Jimmy Page and all of those guys, I was just discovering, you know. After the Hendrix thing, I was going, oh my God, look at that, you know. So it was like that kind of a thing. It was cool.
So you're learning a guitar, you're getting good. Now, when do you decide, I'm going to get a band? Who was your first band?
They were called the Jades. And I don't think that I'd really discovered blues yet, because it was like kind of a Beatle kind of a band. I think I was maybe 13 or 14, maybe. Right around in there, you know. And then, you know, I did discover some other people. It's a weird thing, because the order of it was so intertwined and weird. It's like, then I discovered like the Kinks, you know, and just a lot of influences. This was like, hit me, you know. I guess being young is like, your ears are open, like on, start catching stuff and going like, oh, you know.
What did you like about the Kinks? What was it? Because I love the Kinks. I mean, I just remember I saw them at the Spectrum in Philadelphia, and I was in high school, and it was just amazing. It was such a, I still remember that show. And Ray Davies like ran into the audience, and I was like, holy shit, there's a guy in the audience. But what was it that you liked about the Kinks so much?
Dave Davies, the story about, I mean, all day and all the night, and really got me and tired of waiting. Those three songs in particular that I really liked, because it was like this weird kind of like not buzz distortion, but real distortion. And, you know, later I thought it was a fable, but it wasn't, because, you know, I follow Dave now and he goes, oh no, I cut the speakers with a razor blade, the speaker cone itself. And that's what made it like rattle and distort, not real pure distortion, not fuzz tone, fuzz boxes stuff. And I heard that sound and I was flipping out too, you know, because it's like tone is like a lot to me as well, you know, and Jeff Beck's tone, and, you know, so much.
It's so cool, you know, when I talk to musicians, because musicians fascinate me, because you guys have like, you have an ear, like for comedy, I can write a joke. Okay. And a lot of people can't do that. I know how to do that. But if you I hear songs and I go, man, like with some of your licks that you played with Motley and the licks on this, I'm like, they're just so cool. I'm like, God, I wish I could do that. Cause that's a lot sexier than telling a joke and a microphone. But for you now, When do you start hanging around the LA Strip? When do you start getting into that scene? Because I want to know, eventually you change your name and you become Mick Mars. What led to that change? Because it was a transformation.
Well, I would go up to the Strip every once in a while, but not trying to do anything, just hanging out for a moment. Because mostly I was in cover bands and that kind of crap. But I was in a band called Vendetta, okay? And when those guys were together, and there's a last picture of the band because we didn't make any money. And so there's a picture of us standing in front of the Golden Bear at the side just before they tore it down. At that moment, at that picture, I became Mick Mars. And I went up, I was about 28 or 29 maybe. And that's when I went up to Hollywood and put my name in, ad in the paper and all of that stuff. And that was that. Because I didn't hang out at the Strip much. Yeah. So I guess I was a new, refreshing kind of a person or something. I don't know.
Now, how did you pick the name Mick Mars? Because it's just something, did you want to go for a dark look? I mean, how do you recreate yourself? Because it worked, but it's like, when I recreated myself, my hair fell out. So I was bald, so I had to recreate myself. But what did you do? How did you come up with the name Mick Mars?
Well, you know, it was, I borrowed it. I'll leave it at that one. I don't know. I never liked my birth name, right? And being called Bob. Hey, Bob. Bob. I go, nah, I need something a little more. So Mick Mars came.
And, so you become Mick Mars and you go to the Strip. So yeah. you start hanging out at the Strip more. Now, who was hanging out at the Strip then when you became Mick and you went really Hollywood? Who were some of your contemporaries, should I say, at that time?
There was Quiet Riot, of course. Randy Rhoads was in there and Rudy Sarzo. And, you know, those kinds of people, I was going to, yeah, great band, great guitar player, that kind of stuff. But then, at the same time, I go up there and see, like, the new wave bands or the punk bands and stuff. I wasn't too much into that, but watching a few bands like that, you know, and seeing that, I'm going like, yeah, that's cool, you know. But when when Quiet Riot was playing with Randy and, you know, the original guys, there was a lot different sound to them than all the other bands on the Strip and off Strip, you know, that stuff, Troubadour and those kinds of places. But they, the only one I could really have say that it really stood out was Quiet Riot for me. And then
Now, did you feel that you could hold your own with them? I mean, how was the confidence in your own guitar playing at that time?
Well, I felt I was a bit different for sure. And, I'm not trying to be a butt again, but a lot of the guitar players on the Strip were playing through these, you might as well have had like a big horn on the, on the floor or something, because it was all, you know, nasally horn sounding 500K. That scared me. I was more into tone, and, you know, I played how I played, but tone is an important part. I don't know. So I guess I came like, you know, I don't know, when I first, this is going to be weird because I'm saying stuff like a little bit out of order, but I was living on a garage floor. Just the garage floor that would flood when it rained. So I had a hard time. I'm going, I need to get out of. So, you know, all the stuff, you know, and just and you know, when I met well, when Nikki called, of course, you know, I like fell together pretty quick, and we had like a gig, I think, within a couple of months at the Starwood, and then it just blew up. So
now, in those early days, well, how long did it take you guys once Crew formulated, how long did it take you to get a record deal? Because I heard back then after Quiet Riot got their deal, there was a lot of record deals going out. But how long did it take for you guys to get a record deal?
How long did it take? Oh, maybe, I don't know. Not quite a year. I don't think it took a year because we had our own label, Leather, which, because I had a backer, just myself. And I had the name Molly Crew, right? So it's like, you know, with all that stuff going on and a different kind of like a foreign sounded thing, and over in Europe, they knew we were American, and over in America, they thought we were from Europe. So it's like, all that stuff just like kind of fell together, a different sound, a different type of name, a different this. We had our own record out, and it didn't take long for, Tom Zutaut, who was stacking records at the time at Elektra, and he goes, "You need to sign this band to the big boys," and they came down and we were signed. It was also another offer we got from I can't remember the name, but they were a little bit more bigger and offered more money, you know, from then Elektra. And I said, you know, to the guys that we should go with Elektra because it's less money for us to pay back and we'll see profits sooner. So, you know, it was that kind of thing. But it took maybe 8-9 months, that around there somewhere.
Now, you know, you mentioned the backer. And then, you know, you guys cultivated a look, and you mentioned about paying the money back. You seem to have a good business acumen. Where did that come from? Because most people just say, ooh, we got a deal. Let's sign it. And they go, oh, shit, we owe whatever. How did you have the brains to do that? Was that just because you were a little older than the other guys? Or did you grow up with your parents having a business background?
Well, I knew that. I guess that would be like, One way of saying it was like, for me, I knew that whatever record company or whatever, if we got a deal, we'd have to pay that money back, of course. And I was going like, well, this is, you know, it's just like common sense for me. And, you know, so, I mean, that's how that came together, you know, just being sensible about stuff. And, I don't know.
Now, when do you guys start getting constant work? Do you start at the Strip, then go out on a tour with a band? What was your growing? Because, you know, it's back then the Strip was exploding. I'm bummed. I lived in LA for 18 years and I moved after that whole scene had happened. And I always wished I was around because I heard the LA, the Sunset Strip was just insane. But were you guys playing like every night? Were you playing the Whiskey? Were you playing, you know, Gazzari's? I mean, what was it like when you started getting hot?
That was another kind of a hype business kind of a thing, to where it's like, because I had the backer, we could play the Sunset Strip and do this and do this. But then to make us look bigger than we are, we book a place up in San Francisco. We book a place up in Canada. We do this, and move around because we had the ability to do that, which, not to be a weird guy, but you know, to move around like that, bands in LA really weren't making any money, right? Luckily, we had a backer so we could do that kind of a thing, which broadened our, you know, our audience and our listeners and stuff, and actually made us look a lot more bigger than what the band was.
Now,
Secrets.
well, that's smart because you know, and you're right. You expanded. Once again, it sounds like a good business acumen. But now, when do you sit there and start opening for? When do you start that first? When's the first tour when you guys actually go out with a band and you know it's a tour?
Probably with it was 1984 with Ozzy Osbourne. I think that was the real first tour. We went out on smaller tours and stuff, and the first one I remember is with Quiet Riot, and we opened up for Quiet Riot at a few like little fair type things, not a lot. And then we did the US Festival, I think it was called. Yeah. And that helped explode the band as well. And another business thing, I think, and I don't want to think, that I know what Sharon Osbourne was thinking, but who's like a good new band that can draw some people, go out, and somehow like we came up, and I can't really say it's clear on what happened, but I think there was some kind of a vote or something that went on in schools or something. That's what I heard. I couldn't bet my life on it, but Ozzy and Sharon came and was like, to open up, Of course, it wasn't like directly to me or the band. It was like to the manager, and it's like, yeah, let's go, And so that was the first real, really big tour.
Now, when you're on tour, do you feel your guitar playing getting stronger? Because when I did comedy, like if you work like 6 nights in a row, you got tight. And when you worked, when you, I don't perform as much anymore. I do every month now. But when I would do like 200 shows a year, you got tight. Every night you're grinding it. Could you feel your guitar, just your live performance and your guitar feeling getting better because you're playing in bigger venues now?
Yes and no, because yeah, I felt stronger, and I could play the volume that I liked. But also, there's some parts of me that got worse. Like, I started, drinking. I said, anyway, yeah. So after that, it got a lot stronger, a lot stronger. And
Now, do you remember the first time you heard yourself a song on a Motley Crue song on a radio? Because a lot of people say they might be driving down Sunset Strip, they heard it, or some people said, "Oh, I was at my friend's house and his sister was playing it." Do you remember the first time you heard a Crue song on the radio?
Yes. I believe it was Too Fast for Love, and it was in. I was living in Redondo Beach at that time. And yeah, it came on. It's like that. And also some of the shows that we play, the DJ would be going like blah, 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 and here's a new band, and Take Me to the Top or something would come on. It's like, well, there's us, there's it was cool, The first time to hear yourself on the radio is something.
I mean, what seriously, if you can express this, because you're a writer, what does it feel like? I mean, because that's a feeling that only so many people could think of. But do you just sit there? Is it the holy shit, I'm on the radio, or like, oh my God, I've accomplished something?
Yes, that one. I did it. I did it. Everything that I wanted to do is I'm doing it now. Yes, that's how I felt.
Now, as you start getting bigger and bigger, how does your life change? You know, because it's you're in the public eye now, and you're never going to get that back. People know you, and especially the band. You're different looking guys. You know, it's not like you're midway. If you're in the Midwest, they're not going, "Oh yeah, these are a few accountants at the firm." But how does your life start changing as you start getting more popular? How do you keep yourself in check? Because any performer, I always say, performers were a mixture of we're a little bit narcissistic and we're also insecure. So it's a weird combination. Like we want the attention, but then we're like, oh shit, do we deserve the attention? How did you handle it as you guys were getting bigger and bigger?
Well, I guess for me, I can only speak for me because I only have my own brain, but never believe your own hype. One, never talk about politics. Number two, and you know, is maybe that made me seem a little more shy. You know, it's like, cause I was going like, I mean, the hype and stuff, you can go in your room and go like in your bedroom or whatever and like jump, bounce off walls. So good up on stage and act like, you know, look at me, you know, never felt that way. It was like, thank you for loving what I do, cause it's what I want to do. But don't, no, I was never that guy. Never talk politics, never talked about, I was always a strong believer, don't believe your own hype, because it's what it is.
Now, I went to college in the 80s, and as I said, I did comedy in the late 80s, and there was a big party scene. What was it like? What is the, when they say, you know, sex, drugs, and rock and roll, and, you know, especially with the genre you guys are in, is that all the truth or is it exaggerated? I mean, or is it what whoever chooses what they plan to do?
For an old guy like me, it was more, not really drugs, but alcohol and rock and roll until I figured it out, you know, and then it was, but the ladies liked the young boys. You know, now I was the old guy. Yeah, so I mean, I can't say I didn't have a fair share, but you know, it's like another one of those things. You just like, you know, just is what it is. You know.
Now, tell me, what was your favorite video to shoot back in the day? Because I grew up in MTV watching that stuff. Was there one video that stuck out? Because people don't understand, when you guys go to shoot a video, you're there all day. You get there, you got to sit in a trailer, you got to do that. And you guys, video. What was your favorite video to shoot?
I don't know. Maybe Dr. Feelgood. It was a little edgy, a little... You know, MTV came back to us a couple of times saying, you can't have this there. You can't have this there. You can't. You know, so I would say that. I mean, I could say Home Sweet Home, but that was a very safe video, but it was done three times. You know, so I'd have to probably go along with Feel Good, something like that.
It's funny, Home Sweet Home. I remember I was at spring break in Fort Lauderdale and they would have MTV's top video, and that was number one every day, and we would watch it in our hotel room, then we'd go out and drink.
Yes, and I think it was for 15 days in a row or something, or yeah. Something like that. Yeah.
Now in the early days, what was the writing process with you guys? Because I know you were involved with a lot of writing in the earlier days. What was it? Would you do the music? Would you figure the guitar riff? Because I always wonder, because you're the lead guitarist, you do these great riffs. Would you write that riff, or how would that work in some of the songs that you wrote when you were in the early days of Crew?
I would go home, you know, because I had a little tiny Tascam, 8-track player, and I'd put ideas down just like I do now and figure out what would be cool, and you know, not whole songs, licks, a lot of different licks and stuff. Sometimes the guys would bring in a song and I'd go and I'd go like, it needs a better lick. And so I would change it up. Girls, Girls, Girls was one of those. And it was too bouncy and too happy, I guess. And so I don't know. I was a bit buzzed when I wrote the lick, but I went into my room, my studio, and I wrote the lick, and I came back the next day a bit hungover. And I go, "How's this for girls, girls, girls?" And I played him the lick and I played him the song and the parts, and they were like, "Oh, that's great." And then it just fell together. And going like, okay, we need like an opener thing. And that's where the first opening chord, which was a kind of a, it was G, but it had like open strings to make it sound bigger. So I don't know, that, just stuff like that, you know, just playing around, having fun.
I love your guitar work on Don't Go Away. I don't know. I love that. So, cause it starts, the song starts off sort of slow, but then you just jam. I mean, did that come easily to you? Don't Go Away, Matt. I mean, cause I was listening to that a few times this weekend. I just love the guitar work.
That was just off my head. Just like, I just played, you know, just played it, you know, whatever came. Improv, I guess, improvise it. And, you know, there's some punches, you know, back and forth, you know, with Bob and stuff to go like, okay, this part's great, this part, you know. So I just played it a bunch of times, but pretty much the same kind of a thing. But, you know, there's some fumbles that you do, you know, when you play a solo and stuff. So we kept the good parts, put the good parts together and did that. But it was just like off the top of my head.
Now, what... studio wise on albums, what was your favorite lick to play? What's your favorite song? I want to hear what your studio song was, and then I want to hear what your favorite lick live was. But what was your favorite song when you look back and you were really happy with what you created in the studio?
Misunderstood. That was a great song. As far as the four originals, probably the Dr. Feelgood album was, I think that was like pretty much of a peak, but a good place to stay. But, you know, it took a left, I guess, somewhere. not the album, but the next record.
Now, what was your favorite song to play live, and that you think that the crowd just loved it?
Live Wire.
Really? Why?
Yeah, because it was Live Wire, because it was like pretty pumped up, and people knew how to do the Live Wire, you know, the hook, you know, and jumping up and down and pogoing and stuff. So yeah, probably that one was the most fun to play.
Now, I heard you played very loud in the studio. And is it true there's a story that Aerosmith told you to turn your music down?
Yes.
So what happened?
Bob Ezrin came in when we were at Little Mountain doing Feel Good, I think. Yeah, because Aerosmith was doing Pump at the time. And yeah, it leaked over on their tracks. Steve Tyler told me too. He goes, "Hey." But Ezrin came over a couple of times going, "Hey, how did that?" And no, I didn't. But yeah, I believe that there should be, if you could isolate it, there you would probably hear my guitar.
That's something great. You know, you should get asked for royalties for that. Say, "Hey, I played on that." What's your favorite Motley Crue album you played on? What do you think's the best album?
I think what the best album was the self-titled Motley Crue record, but also the ones that the original is probably Feel Good. I think Feel Good was a great record.
Now, did you like working with Karabi? Because I've had Karabi on the show, and he's a fellow Philadelphia guy, and I like John.
Yeah, I really like John a lot. I think he's a great guy. I think he's a great writer. I think he's a great singer. He's a great guitar player. Everything about him, you know, is really cool. I mean, you know, John, how could you not like him? You know?
And he's a Philadelphia Eagles fan like me. So now on the new album, what's your favorite song off The Other Side of Mars? What would you say if someone said, pick one song, Mick, what would you pick and why?
Probably Killing Breed and Undone are my favorites, and probably Killing Breed. It's a little more of a step away from what I've been doing. This new stuff that I'm writing is more leaning toward Undone and Killing Breed. But also, you know, I also have like a lot of really, you know, bang and, you know, jump up and down and beat your buddy's face in with a bat kind of stuff. But that kind of a thing, those two particular songs is the next step where I would like to go.
So you said you're writing, so you're planning, you're working on, are you planning on having another solo album, or is it just something you're working to see where it goes, or where are you right now?
I have four really, really strong songs. And you see, Chris Collier, the guy who mixed and mastered the album, and I have been working on those for a while. I recently sent over one of the songs to Paul. And yeah, so it's like that kind of a thing. It's like that the working process on this one, I mean, it's a little different, but it's not, you know what I mean? I have to have co-writers because, you know, I got a lot of the stuff in my mind, but to get it out, somebody needs to dig a little deeper in that brain and go like, hey, you know? And yes, I mean, you know, that kind of thing. I have like at least three of those songs are in that direction. But then I have another one. All of these are just like working titles. It's now called Fear. And it's more of a really radio friendly hooky song, you know. I don't want to alienate a lot of people with my weirdness, you know, but yeah.
So you've had this long career. When you look back, what are some of the accomplishments that really stand out to you? When you sit there and, you know, when you look back at your life, what can you sit there and go, man, I'm really proud of this. What are some moments that you are very proud of in your career and your life?
Well, first off, you know, making it to the big time, I guess, you know, that would be the one, because like ever since, you know, I was that little kid, you know, it's like, it's finally here. I'm doing it. I'm actually doing what I wanted to do. A lot of sacrifices, of course, you know, but to do what you really want, you have to make those. So that's a regret, right? But the other one that's not is like, I did it. The first, another thing was my tone on my guitar, because everybody was going like, you know, like I said earlier, you know, my tone is so important to me. It's like, and when people are trying to copy my tone or try to do this, or how do you get that? Where do you get that? Mixed guitar is so big and so fat. And, you know, even like, you know, Gene Simmons comes up and he goes, man, your guitar is big, you know, it's like, and stuff like that. And so that's quite a compliment too, you know? So it's like, you know, things like that.
How many guitars do you have?
Well, for my collection, I have probably close to 200. But these are, I have my few favorites, you know.
What are your favorites?
Well, the main white Strat that I use on stage, it doesn't sound like any other of my guitars for some reason. I don't ask me why, but it doesn't. And a few of my Strats, I mean, the Fiesta Red one and some of those like that. I got a 60 Les Paul, which is very nice. I hardly play it though. But you know, like those ones that mostly like I take on tour are my favorites. I got several instruments. I have Dobros back to the first year, then the National Steel guitars and stuff in 1917. You know, and stuff like that. But mostly I collect guitars because I wanted to open a music store when I'm retired, you know, when I'm done. And I have, I don't know, I've been collecting them 40 years, you know, and Marshalls as well. I have like 64 Marshall stacks, you know. So when I open up a music store, it's going to be nothing but guitars and amps and a lot of pedals. You know,
Yeah.
but that's kind of what inspired me to do that, because I just wanted to, you know, when you get like, you know, and walking out with a cane and being like, or whatever, you know, it's just like something that I felt would be a lot of fun to do, you
What
know.
would you call the store? Do you have a name for your store?
Mars Bars and Thrills, I don't know.
One more question. I want you to give me it's a two-part. Just give me two good rock and roll stories to go that happened to you that you that stick out in your head. And you don't have to name any names, you don't have to do anything, but just two things that you said, "Man, I'm a damn rock star."
I can't really remember any, really. I wasn't like throwing TVs out the window. I wasn't like cutting mattresses in half, which did happen, but it wasn't me. But, you know, it gave me a stomach ache a little bit, actually. But, you know, it was done. I go, well, there you go. You know, Led Zeppelin did it, you know, it's like that kind of, but I can't think of really anything that I did that was, I'm a rock star, I can do that.
Okay, well, we won't ask you that. We'll ask you, what was your most memorable show?
That's a hard one too, because I feel the same all the time. I don't know. Doing three guitar solos in one night.
Where did that happen?
Well, there was a couple accidents on the stage, and so I had to cover, you know. No, that wasn't a very good memory. But God, you know, I can't really point one out, because it's like, you know, it's like I don't remember anything that was like really something outstanding that I did, except, you know, play my guitar.
Except kick ass on stage, which you always did. So now the album. What do you want your fans to love about The Other Side of Mars? What is there something that you're aiming to get your fans just loving it? I mean, a certain point.
Well, the other side of Mars, I'm meaning like there is a different side to me, a side, when I mean, like I said, when I wrote Motley Crue songs, they were Motley. And now I'm writing songs that are me, to expand, to go out to different areas, and to have people accept it and take it in as much as they have is very, not just flattering, but I'm just like going like, God, unreal, unreal. Because, you know, reinventing myself is, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. And people really going with it and listening to it and going like, wow, this is some really good stuff. You know, and I go, well, it's been there, but it wasn't Motley material, it was Mick Mars material, you know. So it's like, you know, just growing, moving, taking the next step.
Well, that's awesome. You definitely have taken the next step in this album because it is great. And we're going to look forward to another album because I know you're not going to open that Mars Bars and Stars store for a while now. But I want to thank you for coming on, people. Thank you for coming on, Mick. People, go to mick-mars.com. You know, you can buy the album or the CD, and there's an option where he'll autograph it for you. How cool would that be? You have a vinyl of his album, and he's signed it. Also, go to my website, coopertalk.net. This is episode 1000. And you can email me at cooper@coopertalk.net. Net, and you can follow me on at Twitter at Cooper Talk. And I want to thank my producer today, Joe Gangemi. If you're in this, if you want to start a podcast or you need a studio, look up Suite Recording, SUITE recording.com. I'm Steve Cooper. I'm only as hip as my guest. Don't forget, drink your water, eat your vegetables, take your vitamins, and I'll talk to you next time.